You're listening to the Light Novel Podcast. Visit us online at lightnovelpodcast.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Light Novel Podcast. Tonight, we are going to be talking about Katana Gatari, the new Nishio Ishin series that has been recently released in English by Vertical. Vertical was actually very, very kind enough to supply copies of the book for us to do reviews. And hang in there for the episode till the end. We will have a little giveaway that we're going to be doing. It's our inaugural giveaway for the Light Novel Podcast. Once again, thanks to Vertical. And so we'll start off with the news. But first of all, we've got a bit of the crew with me tonight. I have Flies.
By the time this podcast is over, you already would have been torn to pieces.
We have Jean-Luc.
Cheerio!
We have Kyle.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm about at that point too. And we have Terrence.
Aren't I the darling of the gods?
Oh no. That was so cheesy, that one. Anyway, okay. And also, for all of you listeners, we are recording this several hours later than we normally do at night, so if all of us start sounding a little dopey or ridiculous by the end of it, we do apologize. First of all, there's just some really brief little news. Mostly it looks like a couple of anime adaptations and such. First of all, getting a new anime is going to be the series Hashinate Sore wa Inai Desho. It's a fantasy light novel series with a normal average employee for a trading company who wakes up and finds himself inhabiting the body of a five-year-old boy who is the eighth son of a destitute noble family in a fantasy world. And hilarity ensues. I don't know much about the series. It has appeared a couple times on the top 10 countdown, so I have some idea of what it is, but I believe the whole idea is like because he's the eighth son, he basically is kind of this outcast because he doesn't have strong enough magic to really do anything good, and he's not very notable for his ability to run anything, and it's just kind of him finding his way in the world, I believe. Next up we have, I don't know, is The 12 Kingdoms necessarily considered a light novel?
Maybe.
Apparently in 2019 we're getting the first new 12 Kingdoms novel in 6 years. That's apparently coming back. According to Anime News Network, the 12 Kingdoms depicts a fantasy world which is inspired by classical Chinese literature, where a girl named Yoko Nakajima finds herself after being transported from Japan. She becomes embroiled in the politics of the Kingdom of Kei as well as the other kingdoms. There was an anime based on this one as well, so whether it's technically a light novel or not, it's certainly in the interest of the community.
1,000 page, I wouldn't categorize it as light.
True, that's like almost a Lethal Weapon right there. In terms of English audiences, we got the news that Yen Press has finally licensed a Konosuba spinoff, An Explosion on This Wonderful World. So these, of course, if you can't figure it out, are the Megumin spin-offs. This is a prequel series, is that right?
Yes, it is. It leads all the way up till the point she joins the party.
Okay. And I think there's three novels in this, and then there was like a sequel series to this one, if I recall reading.
Yeah. Yeah, there's there's the Megumin ones, the prequel, and then there's one that kind of takes place where she joins a band of thieves. And okay. I'll just leave it there because I think they just covered it in the recent English release.
Okay.
Well, there's also the one with where the main character is Dust, that guy who's friends with Kazuma.
Yeah, so they haven't, as far as I know, they've only, these are just the first, like, three, and it's the prequel series that's focusing on, like, the Crimson Magic Clan and Megumin and Union. So we will be getting that, I think they said, around June of 2019. For you Sound Euphonium fans, apparently the series is getting two new novels. Yeah, which is kind of interesting. We only got the first one in English, and as far as I know, that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's coming back, so... Mm.
Yeah, I don't know if we're going to get any more of it. There really hasn't been any word, so... But, well, you know, who knows? Maybe it'll inspire more anime, so... Yeah, we'll see. Finally, another anime adaptation, which is Itai no wa iya nano de bogiyoryoku ni kyoku furi shitai to omoimasu. Wow, I butchered most of that. This one basically is about a girl who decides to play a VR MMO, but she doesn't really like the experience because she's afraid that she'll feel pain. And so she pours all of her points into defense and basically gains a skill known as absolute defense and goes through the game and is basically impervious to crap. I don't know. That's about it.
Mm-hmm. It's Shield Hero Shoujo Edition.
Yeah. Pretty much.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah, sort of. Although I'm pretty sure it's a pure, like, VR MMO thing. It's not like she's an isekai situation, I'm pretty sure. Again, this one's been in the top 10 a couple of times. So, I mean, its sales obviously have done well enough that they've announced an anime for it. So there you go. I find it funny, though, that we're still, like, we just talked about Kono Light Novel Gosugoi last episode, and there's still books on that list that have been on that list for multiple years that don't have anime announcements, and yet these sort of weird series that hardly anybody talks about are getting anime. So I don't know, whatever.
Well, it's like in music, like sometimes you have one hit wonder and you don't hear about the band or the music years after.
Yeah, could be. But all right, so really, like I said, that's about the extent of the news. So
I just wanted to mention Seven Seas has a survey. It's, you know, ongoing right now. I think it'll still be up by the time we upload, if we get this one in 2018. But if you want to hop on there, you can ask for up to eight light novel licenses and 8 manga. So just go check it out. They're categorized by genre.
Oh, yeah, that's right. well, you know what? We'll probably really want to talk about that in our next episode, because we're going to talk about, in our next episode, which will be the first one of 2019, preview time, we'll be talking about some of the series that we'd like to see get licensed in 2019. Might be a good time for us to try that whole, hey, listeners, go fill this in the category of... Anyway, we'll talk more about that towards the end of the show. So so we'll go right into Katana Gatari, because like I said, this is we're actually recording this quite late at night, so we're gonna try and not be 3 hours long. So as I said, this one is by Nishio Ishin. Now, just to explain the vertical release, because we'll be talking about this as being volume one, but it in the vertical release, it is volume one, but technically it's an omnibus, which means it has volumes 1, 2, and 3 of the Japanese releases in the single volume. In Japan, Nishio Ishin released this a book a month for a year for a total of 12 volumes. So Vertical is going to release it as 4 omnibus volumes. It's a really nice book. It's a hardcover. And instead of a slipcover on the front, the actual graphic is printed on the hardcover itself, which I kind of like because it means it doesn't get all mashed up if I put it in my bag to read it. And so what they've done is the cover of this one is the first cover of the first volume that was released in Japan, and then volumes 2 and 3 are available as full color pullouts in the book itself. So you still have all of the artwork. And this one, written in the third person, well, in Nishio Ishin's very conversational, omnipotent author type third person. So it's a little different. Like, Nishio Ishin, of course, known very much for the Monogatari series, Bakke Monogatari and all the rest, which are told in first person in the books. So this one's a little bit different. And it chronicles the tale of two individuals seeking out a set of 12 cursed swords. And, well, would we say that they're cursed? I mean, I guess maybe we'll have to talk about that. They're not necessarily cursed. But we have our first main character is Shichika, who is a... Well, he was raised on an island. We'll probably talk about that as part of the spoiler bits because it's sort of a long story. But basically, he is a master of a martial arts school that he is a swordsman who fights without a sword. And then we have Togame, who is this white-haired girl that is apparently a high up in the government and is seeking out these swords for... supposedly for the current shogun. Is that what he's calling himself? I know they call them the old shogun, the previous one, but this is the Bakufu?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's still called the shogun.
Yeah, like that's still his position, right? Bakufu is his name, but he's the shogun, right?
Yeah, he's the head of the shogunate.
Yeah. So essentially she's trying to curry favor with him by recovering these swords. And so each book is basically them going after one of these swords. It did get an anime. We were just talking about this. I never saw the anime myself, but Flies, you said each episode was like an hour long.
Yeah, each episode was double length, and just like each, light novel, it was one episode per month.
Oh, okay. All right, and so basically the anime covered the entirety of the series as well, right?
Yeah, each episode covered one volume of content.
Right, which is part of the reason that Vertical actually did these as like an omnibus format, because when you're going through it, you'll find each book is about 100 pages long, which is kind of even short for your average light novel. I won't say that no company has ever charged us $15 for a light novel that was only 100 pages. I won't throw anybody under the bus, but let's just say it's been done. Anyway, Vertical was nice enough to collect this together into one single book, so you have a nice hefty 300-page novel. So yeah, so that's that was kind of, I think, their thinking behind it, because the books were relatively short because, again, they were released one a month. So, with all of that preamble done, what do you guys think?
Well, you mean in general the story or the book format? Or?
Well, I mean, if you want to say something about the book format, please do.
Well, I found the book format really interesting because, it's the first hardcover I have in terms of light novel. And, well, just like I was watching earlier yesterday, like a video about sensory element in board game, and something like the feeling that you have when you engage with some component is something like out of the ordinary or something you're looking for. And in this case, like when you hold this hardcover in your hand, like it feels rewarding. Like I can't really explain it. It's kind of like an old feeling that when I was younger and I read like big hardcover book, like there's this feeling of importance, like there's something that weight in your hand. It's not something that's super light and that will break apart in while you're holding it. It's, I don't know, but it's really a great quality hardcover. Like again, like the feeling of holding it is great. And one other thing, I didn't find any typo in it. So that's something that's really good, because a lot of other light novel I've been reading, like, I get like sometimes stuck upon typo error, and that really breaks my readings, and didn't find any in this one.
Yeah. Like, I don't know if you guys have been reading the Monogatari books. Like, Nishio Ishin, I mean, to any readers who aren't familiar with Nishio Ishin, Nishio Ishin is very much known for lengthy conversations, word plays, sort of word puns and stuff like that, which don't always translate amazingly into English. But I have to say, Vertical has done a really, really good job in the Monogatari books. And you're right, Jean-Luc, like in this one too, like I would say of most of the books that come out light novel wise, Vertical probably puts out some of the cleanest translations in terms of being grammatically correct and not having typos and stuff like that. One thing I think we have to mention, if we're talking about the book just as a book, is the footnotes on the pages.
It definitely seems like they went like beyond what we were expecting, because this isn't the first light novel series that we've gotten that has had like footnotes and translations notes. Like, you have Oregairu, which has the glossary in the back of the book each volume, or you have like the Saga of Tanya the Evil, which has it on the bottom. But like, they in like Katanagatari, they pretty much gave us like the Japanese spelling and exactly how you pronounce the Japanese words, as well as telling you what the definition is or like what the meaning is.
Yeah, but I found it a little bit different between this one, Katanagatari, and say Tanya the Evil. Like, in Tanya the Evil, the footnotes are mainly for fake historical event or fake plays, that it's bonus information to set you more in that world. And it almost feel like it's an obligation to read in order to know what's going on. And as this one, it's basically translation note. So sometime when I read some part that I had more time, I would look more at those footnotes, and other time I was just passed by and I didn't miss out on anything.
Yeah.
So,
did anyone actually read all of the translation notes while they were reading it?
Oh, God,
I read them as I was going, but if you asked me to remember all of them, no. But but there were a few times where I felt like you had to read the translation notes. Like, there's one on page 234 where they say, "The building complex was no less majestic than the Thousand Stairs or the enormous Torii," which is fine. "Triad Shrine was a fastidiously kept example of Gongenzukuri. Dogami had only just explained that this was a kind of Yatsumune Zukuri, where the Honden is separated from the Heiden by a patio of stone." Like, for that particular block of sentences, you kind of have to use the footnotes.
Yeah.
So there were some instances where it was almost like, I want you to read the footnotes, even though at the beginning they say, you know, they're unnecessary, you don't have to look at them. That was definitely one instance where, yes, you do.
Yeah. Well, I think that what I found interesting, like, I think, honestly, the footnotes to me, when I was looking through it and I was reading it, I found that, yeah, I did that. Like, whenever it was a Japanese term, I thought, oh, and so I would look down at the footnote and be like, oh, okay, I get it. And I think that it's actually a really interesting thing to me. I mean, the translator says at the beginning that part of the reason that he feels Vertical wanted it was because this is sort of a period piece. This isn't a modern world or even a fantasy. Like, it's set after the Warring States period in Japanese history, right? So it is kind of a period piece. And so he was kind of like, well, I'm including translation notes for certain things. And I got the impression that when he left intentionally the Japanese in the main body, that it was because that term there isn't like so much a straight ahead or easy translation of, because it's more of like a philosophy or a Japanese idea. But most of the other ones, it was just telling you like why he chose that particular wording. I think if you're into translation or you have questions about translating Japanese into English, I think even just in that way, it's an actually really cool book to have, just to even see the mindset of a translator in terms of what the thought process is in terms of, okay, well, this is the Japanese, and then, you know, what wording do I use for it in English? Yeah, I thought it was really awesome. And like you said, I mean, yes, it's obviously different. Like Tanya the Evil, they are much more about the in-worlds type stuff. In terms of My Youth Romantic Comedy, As Wrong As I Expected, that those are because Hachiman does nothing but toss out pop cultural, you know, classical literature references so much that there's no way that anybody could understand them unless you were steeped in that stuff in Japanese. So, I mean, they all serve different purposes, but I really felt this one was like, man, if I was like a student of translation, or I was a translator or whatever, or very interested in that, this is probably the first one I've seen that really I found instructional in that kind of way.
Well, if I had a bit more time, I would have read a bit more of it, because having studied Japanese, like there's a couple of things that when I saw some words, like, and not necessarily the Japanese word, like when I saw a specific English word, I was wondering, oh, so what was the thought process behind translating it? Because, I don't remember the name, but I was playing once a game on PS3, and the voice was in Japanese, but it was English translated, and I was reading one thing and hearing another one, and like the translation wasn't bad in itself, it was a good translation, but there was so much in the original language that was something like one sentence in Japanese can have different meaning, one word can have different meaning, and sometimes you're stuck translating only one of those meanings, so you're losing out on a lot of different meaning. But at the same time, to give like the exact and all of the experience that you're having while reading it in the original language, you're not able to translated fully in one full sentence, so it would be a lot too long to just do a kind of exact meaning translation. So sometimes there are choices that are made, and that's where I think translation is more of an art than operation task. Like you don't just translate one word for another. You adapt like a reading experience into what you think is the best way to translate it. So two people won't have the same translation.
Yeah.
But it will be fairly similar. But I think the translator's job is something really important.
Yeah. Well, and I appreciate it too. Like, I mean, they give you everything. Like, they give you the kanji, then they give you the romanization of it, and then they give you the definition of it, of the word. And I found it interesting. Like, I didn't read all of them because same thing, you know, kind of pressed for time. Plus, I just wanted to kind of be able to not break my flow and enjoyment of the story. It'd be one more of those things that maybe you would go back afterwards and sort of enjoy picking apart kind of thing. But I thought it was really cool. It's really cool. It's not something that I've really seen done that way before. And because Japanese, I mean, it's not like a lot of Englishes where you really can do a one-to-one comparison where this word equals this word. In Japanese, because some of it is more of impressions and ideas and context, I found it interesting. I thought it was really a cool idea, actually.
It was interesting. Sometimes there would be like a word where it it had the literal reading of something, but it evoked another word that sounded similar. I mean, I think he does that, Nisilisim, with a lot of his wordplay. And so they would do that in the footnote. They would, you know, tell you what it was and then what it sort of evoked, you know, another meaning.
Yeah, but it's not just Nisilisim. Like, it's a lot of, Japanese, author and, Japanese in general, like the language, how it's made. It's easy. There's a lot of word that sounds exactly like another word, but are written differently. And since the kanji themselves have different meaning depending on their use, like it's easier to play on a word when you have this amount of information that you can just reference easily just by putting it out, that it's done in pretty much every work that I've seen.
Yeah, I just one or two times what I really liked was like how there would be a word and you'd be like, what the heck? And you'd look down and it'd be like a nonsense word, means nothing, or you know, like the translator's just like, yeah, it's just Nishio Ishin messing with shit. Like, it's not.
Yeah, sometimes there was like a character name and it was like, this is not a real name.
Yeah. I mean, story aside, and we'll talk about the story next, but even just as a document in terms of the translation and the choices, I thought that was a lot of fun, actually. I'd love to see more books sort of play with that idea, if it's appropriate, obviously. But I mean, this one, yeah, because it was a period piece and because you have samurai, ninja, and you have all that kind of terminology associated with them, I can see where it was actually a really appropriate choice for this particular volume.
Yeah. I took on the challenge to read every single footnote as I went along, and I failed miserably. But not because of length, but there's... Okay, Nishio Ishin, he writes in a very almost schizophrenic way, you could say. You know, he's got lots of wordplay, lots of onomatopoeia. And as you read through the footnotes, you can see that. But as you're going along and, you know, you're seeing dozens of footnotes per chapter, so I'm just going and looking through them all. And some of them, I don't understand why they made a translation note of it. Like, there's one part, I believe it's in the beginning, towards the beginning of book two, where Togami gets called a tool. And the translation note, I believe it said something along the lines of, the literal translation was to use someone as an object. And I'm kind of thinking, I was like, wait, it means the same thing in English as the literal translation. And
yeah, there was another one that was like decoupage, which, you know, I don't know if that's just not a very well-known thing or something, but it's like, it had the literal meaning that was like glued paintings, you know. It wasn't like anything too crazy.
Yeah. And so, you know, as I'm reading this, there's just, I tried keep going through reading all the footnotes, and I was just saying, I was like, I don't understand why, you know, a lot of these have these notes on it. It's like sometimes, you know, the literal definition is the exact same as the word that's used that he
I was wondering if like the author was, or the translator was just trying to back up, like, see, it's the exact same as what I wrote. I don't know.
No, maybe there was some hidden meaning, and that was maybe in the background, that was a bit less important, and he was just justifying his choice. I don't know.
Or it could be that maybe, I mean, obviously, like, I'm not a translator by any means, but maybe when that particular word comes up or that phrase comes up, certain translators have a disagreement about whether you would call it, you know, whether you would do it as a tool, or you would do it as another word, or you know what I mean? Like, maybe it was just him being able to justify, this was my take on this term based on it. Like,
he could have used the word object instead of tool.
I mean, I get tool is like a great, when you're talking about an object that is used, I mean, tool is about as quick and easy a English reference as you're going to get. But yeah, I get what you're saying, Kyle. Like, there was a couple, I definitely saw a couple of those things too, where you're sort of like, I wonder why you felt the need to put a footnote for that. But then there's like some other term that I'm like, that seems, I would want to footnote that a lot more.
Yeah, and so, occasionally. Yeah,
especially when you have architecture words.
Oh, yeah, yeah, well.
Yeah.
Well, and even like I noticed, I mean, just off the top of my head, I can't think of a specific thing, but I mean, there were some less often used even English words.
Oh, yeah. I've got a list. Okay. So I'm just going to rattle these off. Some of these aren't as hard. I just put down a list of a few that I found, but there's passé, which, you know, I think people use, captious, which I've never used in my life. Sagacity or sagacity, which obviously is sage-like, but I've never heard that used. In sooth, I don't know what that sooth was, and there was no explanation of it.
Do you have the sentence?
I don't. No, I do. Down. I have the page. Do you have the book in front of you? It's on page 176. I believe it starts a paragraph too. It's in sooth, because you might be able to figure something out.
Yeah, because some of the word are, I guess, loan word from French.
Mm. Yeah.
And like that one kind of, depending on the sentence, like it,
it's,
it would maybe have been.
In sooth, 10 generations back in the age of warring states, the sword's poison had overmastered Unari's forebearer, Kinkaku Uneri. Yeah, like, in sooth.
It literally, like, just translates to in truth. So, like, I don't know why they didn't just write in truth.
Right. Like, I think that's what we're kind of getting at, is that, like, something like a tool, you put the footnote because it was an object to be used, and you're like, duh, that's the, yeah. But then, when you have some more very flowery or very less used English words that you're just like, where did you even pull that out of? Like, what made you think Japanese-wise that worked? Like,
yeah, and I was wondering if, like, was this a product of Nisio Isin? Was he using a term that was very complicated and flowery, and so the translator wanted to use something? Like, that's what I was wondering about, you know?
Like, it breaks my flow when I'm trying to read, like, an interesting conversation, and then I have to actually go to Google on my computer to figure out what one word means.
Well, I mean, fair enough. Like, I don't want to sound like I'm slagging on the translator. Absolutely not. Like, I mean, again, when you know Nisio Isin and you read about Nisio Isin, you realize that it must be like, you know, another level of hell to try and translate Nisio Isin and still make it make sense and try and make the puns land and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, it was just kind of funny, like you said, when you're talking about the footnotes, that, you know, stuff that seemed really obvious sometimes would be footnoted. And then other words that you were like, why the heck would you even use this? There's no notation whatsoever. Like, it's just like, it's like, hey, I've pulled out a word from like 16th century English that no one's used for 100 years, but I'm not going to footnote why I did it.
Well, I don't know for you guys, but I think the first two volume of Goblin Slayer gave me like I had to take an English dictionary and search like word every like two page. Like there was like, and sometimes it's just those words that are just a bit nuanced from like the common word.
Right.
That is used, like, especially for there was a lot of slight nuance word for like walking, screaming, and stuff like that. Yeah. And I was, okay, never heard those before, but kind of enhanced the reading experience because it's, oh, they try to go for a kind of more, not upscale reading experience, but like fancy word, like it just kind of look cool.
Well, I think sometimes, you know, those kind of words are a bit more evocative, right? Because they aren't, pedestrian. They aren't run of the mill. And I mean, I'm not like, again, like I'm, maybe that was a great choice in the translation. I'm not arguing that at all. It's just, yeah, it's just, you know, when you are putting a footnote for an item for something that is perfectly self-explanatory, but then you aren't putting any notes for words where you're like, I do wonder why he chose that particular word, you know? So, yeah, I don't know. But in any case, I thought the footnotes were really cool. I thought it was a cool idea and, you know, and definitely it gave me some insight to the art of translation. You know, we can quibble about what they should and shouldn't have footnoted, but I think overall it's a really cool kind of thing that they included in the book.
Yeah, especially since you have the option of reading it or not. It's an optional thing. And like, you're not forced to read a single one of them, or you can just come back afterward and read them.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I think it kind of, I think particularly too, like Terrence, when you're talking about the architecture and stuff where they're talking about, particularly like, yeah, in book three, and there's more Japanese terms used, like the romanization of the Japanese terms used, I think it kind of strikes that balance. Because I mean, you do find in the light novel community, there's a lot of people that are a bit more purists that, you know, hate when things are quote unquote over translated or that kind of stuff. I think it's kind of a nice balance that you can still include some Japanese terms and yet still explain it to an audience that may not have any idea what that is.
Yeah, like Iyanuki was a cool term to learn, that's like basically taking the sword out of its sheath like really fast, I think. Yeah. Is Iyanuki. Yeah.
Well, it's normally it's the Iai. So okay. You have Iaido, which is the art of taking out the sword. Iyanuki is the first time I heard that specific word, but it's in the same line. Yeah. Like Iai is just the movement of taking the sword out and slicing with the first strike.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like I did appreciate that there were things that they used romanizations of the Japanese term for, yes, like specific martial arts and stuff like that. I mean, it would have been, I think it would have lost something if you had called it like my sword drawing technique, you know?
Well, the thing is that, I did take some Iaido class in the past, and it's actually called that. Like, it's like karate, like it's a Japanese word, but we use it like because there's no translation that were done for that martial art. So it's the same thing. Like Iaido is actually a word that exists in the martial art community. So it made sense to have it there in romanization.
Yeah. Oh, no, I agree. But, you know, I think that, I think it's that idea of having that balance between, you know, maintaining certain Japanese words and just Romanizing them, or taking the other road of over-translation and trying to Englishify everything that you have in the light novel, right? So I thought it was a nice balance, and I thought it was actually really cool. And yeah, I mean, there was a couple of little historical items and stuff like that they explained, which I thought was pretty neat too. So, I mean, yeah, overall, like it's a great package that way. And we, like I said, we haven't even talked about the story, which, you know, maybe we should, yeah, maybe we'll go on to that part now. Cause yeah, we've already been talking for like over half an hour just about how cool the actual product is, let alone the story itself. So, So yeah, so in terms of the actual story, so I gave the really brief rundown, and I mean honestly, as much as I really enjoyed this book, and as much as I enjoy the Monogatari books, there are times where Nishio Ishin, who was saying it, that he's kind of like it's like reading. It's almost like reading, like it's like a ping pong match, you know, like you're reading and all of a sudden it's like the ball's over there. Oh, the ball's over there. Oh, let's talk about this now. Let's talk about this now. and I mean, it can be sometimes I find it slower to read these books because I sometimes have to go back because I'm like, I think I get the gist of what you're talking about. But there was like five different conversations in this paragraph. So I kind of want to go through it again.
And sometimes, like, he's keeping certain character motivations from you, or he's giving you one thing, but it's not the truth. Like, it's sometimes it's tough to figure out. Yeah.
Like, I don't know if we should spoil this, but about Shichika's father.
Yeah.
Like you learn something really different from what you was told in volume one. So in volume three, you learn something that, oh, okay, that happened. Oh, they didn't say that in the first one.
Well, I mean, I find really entertaining about it is all the fourth wall breaking that Nishio Ishin does.
Yeah, that was really good.
Oh my God. Like, and I mean, he does it in the Monogatari books, like crazy. And I wondered just how much would be in this one. And oh my gosh, like, I mean, like the whole, Cheerio thing and how he keeps saying in another three books, she's going to find out she's wrong and it will lead to five pages of humiliation and remorse.
I really look forward for that. Right?
You know, and like how she's talking about, even though she's talking about how she's going to write the report about what they're doing, you get more of the sense that it's Nishio Ishin talking about the book itself. So, like, Tagame would make a comment like, you have to make this more interesting because nobody's going to want to read it.
Yeah. And then, like, oh, I'm glad that ninja who talked backwards died.
Oh, my God.
So I don't have to read that anymore.
I was going to talk about that because, like, I haven't watched the anime in, I think I watched it, like, 5 years ago. And I briefly remembered as I started reading the second book, I'm like, oh shit, I completely forgot about this guy. Because in the subtitles for the anime, they basically just wrote his words, but like...
backwards.
They wrote the sentence backwards in the subtitles, but then in the book, not only do they write the sentence backwards from, so you have to read it from right to left, but then they also switched the spelling backwards at the same time. So I was like completely struggling to try to like say the sentences. And then I love how a little bit farther into the book, when they first mentioned the ninja and his like secret technique, they're like, oh yeah, thank God he's fine. He's actually dead. So we don't have to try to translate all that shit.
Yeah.
Well, I found it really interesting, but, same as you, like I was, oh God, like, I hope he doesn't stick around for like the entire volume and then, oh, he's just there in the prologue. Oh, good.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But I mean, again, like, and that's what I mean. Like, this is where, like, I love Nishio Ishin's fourth wall breaking, right? Where he's like, you know, and the sudden demise of this character had nothing to do with the fact the author didn't want to keep writing his lines backwards.
I do wonder if some of the fourth wall breaking that he does, though, like sometimes he'll do something where he gives away, like it's not for comedy's sake. He just gives away something that will happen later in the story. Like he mentioned one of the blades that somebody else is going to gain, you know, access to one of the blades they've already captured.
Yeah.
And Shikizaki will face it again.
Yeah, and he, like, says the next time when it's pointed towards his throat. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's certain things he does like that. And some of it is like, ooh, we'll find that out in the next volume or the next few volumes. But some of it is like really far into the future. And it's like, I don't know if it's kind of like him trying to be like anti suspense or him trying to increase the suspense, you know? Because it could go either way. Well, it could
I
be,
think normally, yeah. normally it should be used to increase the suspense. Like you want to make readers look forward to that scene.
Yeah.
But sometimes it kind of like goes the other way around.
Well, I think I get what Terrence is saying. Like, because when you read authors who do that kind of thing, it's usually subtle. Like, it's not so blatant. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, it's like you get this sort of subtle, like, ooh, foreshadowing, right? Whereas Nishio Ishin is like, I'm going to bash you over the head in five volumes. This is what's going to happen. You know, like,
it's like he's highlighting the foreshadowing.
Yeah. It's like he's like, I'm not playing. In five volumes, it's going to get real, and this is what's going to happen. and the only suspense you have is like, how are we going to get there? You don't know. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's not that foreshadowing where you kind of are like, ooh, is he hinting that such and such is going to happen? Or, ooh, is he going to think, is this going to go on? No, you're like, oh, okay. So he's going to have that sword pointed at his throat. Okay. No guesswork involved.
it's kind of like a, like that meme of a, oh yeah, you're probably wondering how I got here. And then it goes back to a flashback sort of thing.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, that's kind of what I was saying before, that Nishio Ishin kind of writes like a schizophrenic, because he'll have Togame on occasion act as his own self insert, where he'll, kind of foreshadow, spoil, break the fourth wall, do whatever. And then he'll straight up break away from the story and then write a couple chapters as the author, saying, it's like, okay, here's what's going to happen next. Here's this going to happen. So on and so forth. Okay. Now back to the story.
One thing I loved was, in the part I was just reading, it was, he was talking about like, what he has to do, like each volume. Oh, I have to do the summary basically each volume. So here's the summary again. Like, yeah. It was almost like, I'm obligated to do this. Here it is again. And, you know, when you read stuff like Shield Hero or some of these other stories where it's like, the summary is almost like one third of the book. It's like, ugh. At least you see a writer who's like, yeah, I have to give it to you again. So here it is again, but it's just a necessary thing. I don't want to do it either.
I appreciate that he puts his own like humor into it, because it gets really weird when like you're like 10 volumes into a series and they have to spell things out for you as if you're you're a first time reader. Whereas like if you're 10 volumes into a series, I would hope you like remember the main character's name and stuff like that.
Well, I mean, you know, it's part of the whole industry. Like, I think we've talked about it in other podcasts about how the format of light novels, because of they're trying to hook people on so many series and everything else, they do kind of obligate authors to recap things, because they figure that between volume releases, you've probably read like 10 other light novels.
Well,
right?
With this one, it would have been a little different, though, because wasn't there a volume every month?
Yeah.
Although I guess for people that are really like read a lot of light novels like us, you might have read 10 or 11 volumes in a month.
Yeah, you could have read a couple of books in between, that's for sure. You know, and yeah, like you said, it's and like you said, that is funny. Like, that is the one thing, that is another thing that you like about Nishio Ishin, about that self insert, about how he's just like, yeah, the editor tells me I have to do this, so. And yeah, I know none of you like it either, but I have to. And, you know, or like, he didn't do it so much in this one, because I don't know if when the anime was announced for this one, but like in the Monogatari books, he does that a lot. He's like, you can't put that in because the anime won't allow that content.
Oh, but,
you know,
little does he know that the Monogatari anime doesn't cut out much content that he writes about.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot of editing, but it's funny just the thought process as an author where he's like, we were going to have this conversation, but Japan just enacted this law and saying that we can't show such and such scenes between characters with an age difference of blah blah blah, so we're going to skip that. And then a character will go on for a page about how the conversation doesn't qualify because blah blah blah. And then they'll have the conversation, it's just like, as far as I understand it, I mean, I don't know a ton about Nishio Ishin, but he is a fairly prolific writer. Like, he writes quite a bit from what I understand. I mean, obviously this series, he did a book a month, even though they're a bit shorter, but still it's a book a month. So it seems like a lot of his stuff is very reactionary to what's happening when he's writing. And he seems to be very free in terms of, like, I mean, this is a period piece, but he has absolutely zero problems using terms and ideas and stuff that are clearly not of that period. And he even just goes saying, like, oh, this was before it fell out of favor to call people this, or, oh, this, or like, what was it when it was Gadzooks he puts in there at one point? And he, you know, just like little shout outs to stuff, like, you're just, yeah. I mean, now what do you guys think though? Like, I mean, okay, this is only the first three volumes. I mean, so it's three volumes. We have the recovery of three swords, spoilers, 12 swords, 12 volumes. I think it pretty much is straight ahead that, you know, it's going to be a sword, a book, at least probably until closer to the end. What do you think? Like, is this going to get kind of maybe a little boring, or have you found, like, even in these first three books, there was enough sort of variety in terms of how they presented stuff that you can see yourself hanging in for 12 books and still being entertained?
Well, I really like the first three one. Like, they seem fairly different. Like, the first one, well, they open up as to who is Shichika and who is Togami. Like, she goes to this inhabited island to get his help to, like, hunt down those swords. And they're ambushed by a ninja that already has one of those swords and wants them dead. And eventually in the second one, well, they go to a castle in the sand in the desert, and they face up against this very traditional samurai. And in the third one, well, it's completely different. Like, there's all of the enemy character is super different. And at the same time, like, the first enemy was a ninja, but you have these 12, again, 12 ninja bosses. Mm-hmm. And the first enemy was also a ninja, but in the other one, I hope that the ninja, like the one that was speaking backward that we talked about earlier, I hope that they would be a bit more important. But it's, I don't know down the road how the other one will be. But the first three one kind of felt like a joke character.
Oh yeah, I think so.
I think it's a gag that he threw in, because in the first volume, when they first talk about the ninja clan that betrays Togame, before the events of the current story, they talk them up as if they're like some elite ninja clan that is known across the land. And then by the third book, like, three or four of them have already been killed off. Some of them, like, completely off screen. And they pretty much just say, wow, that ninja clan, I guess they're not that tough, like, if they keep getting killed off so easily.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there was something they said there, yeah.
Either they're not that tough, or either because they're also hunting down the 12 swords. Like, the owner of the 12 sword are maybe just that good.
Well, yeah. I think that's kind of the thing. I think it's like that running gag, right, is that, you know, they're using the ninjas to show you how hard it is to get the sword, so that when, like, Togame and Shichika get there and get the sword, it's all that more impressive, right? Because you've already watched someone who's supposedly strong get their butt kicked trying to get it.
Yeah, I suppose. But you wonder how Komori got the first sword.
Well, I mean, he basically says, like, then he said the fact that he used like his whole shape shifting thing to basically steal it, right? Like, yeah. It wasn't like a straight up battle. Like, it, he makes it sound like it was all subterfuge and stuff like that. And, like, really, the only reason that they say he ends up getting defeated is just because Shichika's completely ignorant.
I like how both our main characters definitely carry the story. Like, the thing with when you have a story like this where it's very structured, the same structure for each volume, it really depends, your enjoyment really depends on how likable the cast of characters are. And the thing about Shichika is that the book constantly tries to describe him as being, like, having no personality and being boring. But I find his lack of personality or, like, sternness actually makes him way more enjoyable than the book describes. Like, he's supposed to be, like, a country bumpkin who's been living on an island almost his entire life. And then when Tagame tries to explain, like, important things, he just straight out says, like, oh, that sounds really dumb, but go on. And, like, he likes to tease her all the time.
Yeah, it was something interesting where you get the point where it does kind of say that it, you know, he's got a boring personality, and then Togame herself says he's got a boring personality and tries to get him to be more flashy, more showy, try to give him a catchphrase.
Cheerio!
Yeah. Well, I think, again, right, like, that's where you have Nishio Ishin as an author poking fun at everything, because he does make Shichika, he often wants to make this point that Shichika's this stupid, he's dumb, he's not, he's kind of boring and stuff like that. And yet, when you compare him to a lot of other light novel protagonists, he's actually not.
Yeah, well, even in this book, like, I don't think he's that, you know, obviously they're making fun or poking fun, but he's not that dumb. Like, even some of his like, his schemes end up working out in terms of his planning, you know, in terms of fighting against these enemies, whereas a lot of Togame's schemes, like, fail miserably, and she's supposed to be the schemer.
Yeah. Well, I think that's, again, right, it's that whole joke is, you know, is the different things. Like, I love that one point, and I think it was that same conversation you were talking about, Kyle, the whole, like, when they're trying to come up with a catchphrase, and it was like, Shichika knew that he was dumb, and he was okay with it, but could Togame be dumber than he is? That was frightening. Like, you know, where even he's kind of having this revelation that he's like, wait, maybe I'm not the stupid one here. Like, you know. and I think Flies brings up a really good point, is that, you know, I really liked reading these characters. Like, you know, they were a lot of fun and very entertaining. You know, and the relationship between Shichika and Togame is at this point, because of course there's still quite a bit of series to go, but she's just enough tsundere to be fun that way, but yet she's not quite, like,
yeah. Well, I feel like if Shichika was more vulnerable, like, if he wasn't as impervious as he is, some of the things she does, you know, punching wise and kicking wise, in some other books, it would be pretty annoying. But in this book, she doesn't even do a dent on him. So,
well, and, like, but at the same time, though, it's sort of weird, like, the whole thing where she wraps her hair around him so that his muscles will remember her. Like, like, I'm like, I said, I'm just kind of like, dude, I think she's coming on to you.
Well, even when he cradles her up the stairs, they're like, it's a bridal carry.
Oh, that was hilarious.
Yeah, yeah, yes, like, that was hilarious. And like he almost drops her.
Like, she would get embarrassed over him bridal carrying her, but then, like, the book before, he was, like, licking her hair, and she was fine with it.
Yeah, yeah, she won't piggyback him or ride on his shoulders, but she'll let him bridal carry her and lick her hair, and she'll wrap his hair, her hair around his muscles and stuff. Like, yeah, it's just, yeah. I think the thing is, like, you know, going into this, I mean, I had some idea of what Nishio Ishin was capable of. It is much more of like Monogatari than it is like, say, Juni Taisen, which he also wrote. You know, it really is not serious. Like, even the enemies are kind of absurd.
Some of the battles kind of reminded me of Zodiac War, though. The way, I mean, they kind of have to get over in a bit of a flash, but there's more, obviously more setup in terms of these battles. But they kind of have to get over in a flash because Shichika doesn't have, he has a tough body, but he's not impervious to any sword, so he can't get hit. So in that respect, depending on the battle, some of the battles got over a little quick. Yeah.
But I think it's because, Shichika is referred to as being a sword. Mm. And it's this whole idea of generally it's like a samurai sword fight is not like a European sword fight. Like, it doesn't take like a few minutes. Like, it's often dealt in one strike. And that's this whole idea of a katana duel. Like, he's himself a katana, and like oftentimes referred as such. And he's facing off against another wielder with another katana. So, like, it would make sense that these battle would end up in one move.
Well, it's almost like it kind of is. It's like basically trying to say that essentially Togame is wielding him as her sword. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Like that part in book two where he says the enemy, the opponent, says that he notices Shichika's shown up without his guards on his arms and his legs, and he has no shoes on or no sandals, and he's like, he's showing me his weapon. Like, he's showing me his naked blade, basically, right? So yeah, you're right. Like, there's definitely, that's a recurring theme throughout the book, this idea that, you know, Shichika himself is the weapon. It's not even just so much that he is a martial artist, although he's referred to that way too, but it's definitely often, it's like he is the sword himself. And I mean, even in, which was it in book one? I'm trying to remember, but wasn't it in book one? They basically say that, like, the whole story is forging the final weapon and it's him.
Yeah. Yeah. There's something that's referencing him. Like we said, like foreshadowing ahead of time. It's like, he is like the Kyoto Liu is the ultimate like sword that has been forged and that is transferred from generation to generation. So Nishio Ishin is literally giving away that Shichika is the ultimate sword.
Yeah, and wasn't it like, wasn't there the idea that the Shikizaki blades were forged just so, like, the guy that forged them just so this school of the Kyoto-ryo could, like, evolve to, like, the ultimate form? I don't know if that's the idea, but I thought that was kind of hinted at, yeah.
It is, it's that, oh, yeah, like, I mean, spoilers, people, you know, heavy spoilers, but I mean, like, it's right at book one. He says, yet this tale is heading steadily toward a conclusion. All 1,000 of the swords of legendary swordsmith Kiki Shikizaki, including his masterpieces, the 12 possessed, were merely foils for the creation of the Kyoto Ryu, a single katana, Kyoto the Diamond.
Yeah, so they're kind of spinning the wheels and they're just kind of doing almost the bidding of the guy that made the Shikizaki blades, it almost feels like. Like, this is what he wanted to have happen. and yeah. they're playing it out.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Yeah. It's again, like it's obviously Nishio Ishin is to an extent a acquired taste. Cause as Kyle said, I mean, yeah, like he can bounce all over the place, like, you know, conversation wise, narrator wise, like, you know, there's not a lot, you know, you have all of those schools of writing where it's like one scene, one narrator and stuff like that. But like Nishio Ishin at willy nilly, when he's writing in third person, will flip from the point of view to one person to another person. Like it's not, you know, but I think if you read it from the idea that all of it is Nishio Ishin, then you're good. It may sound like it's a point of view of one of the characters, but really it's just all Nishio Ishin's point of view. They're all just self-insert characters for Nishio Ishin. But I think that's the thing. Like, you know, you can definitely make, I think, a case that the book has definitely some filler conversations, but if you, like Fly said, if you look at it from more of a, this is a journey of two characters, those aren't really filler conversations. They're definitely conversations that are furthering their characters and their personalities and their relationship. You know, if you look at it from that point of view, then it's not. But I can definitely see where some people might read these books and be like, oh my God, just shut up and fight.
Well, what I liked about this book, well, this story in whole, is the fact that compared to other one, like you only follow like two or three character at the time. There's always two or three character maximum in one scene, and I think that kind of lightened the weight of the story. Like it doesn't feel like you're lost. You're always following the same character, and even if they go into lengthy description, like you feel like it's always important.
Well, I think, like you said, like you know, and like Flies was saying, it's that whole point of, you know, when you've got a story that has sort of a repetitive format, you know, we're on a journey to find the sword, we find the guy with the sword, we fight the guy with the sword, we get the sword, end of book, next book, find the guy with the sword, fight the guy, you know what I mean? Like when you've got a very repetitive structure, what makes that reading experience interesting is how can you make being invested in the characters and also in making sure that each of those situations is kind of unique. Like, I mean, the three antagonists of this book are all very different from each other, the solution of getting past them is all different from each other, you know, like, and I think that's, you know, exactly. It's the whole point is that you're following these small group of characters. So you're invested in them because it is their story. And because they're interesting and kind of funny and sort of absurd and everything else, like there's a lot of comedy to it and they're enjoyable that way.
Yeah, it's, I remember from the anime series, I won't spoil anything, but
thank you.
Yeah, it does keep up that simple structure for a while, but then it starts adding in things. Things kind of start going out of order. He, as the author, he mixes it up as it goes on for, 12 volumes. So you're not going to be reading the same story every single time.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, that's good to know. Well, this is the thing with Nishio Ishin. I mean, when he says, you know, in book 5, Tagami is going to find out that Chirio is wrong and she's going to be embarrassed and go on for 10 pages or whatever. Sometimes I'm like, now, does he actually have that planned out? Or is he just saying that? And when he gets to book 5, he's going to be like, oh, crap, I got to fit this in.
No, I'm pretty sure he has a roadmap of where he's going.
Yeah. I think so too. But I'm just, you know, like, but just because, like we were saying, like sometimes the conversations are so loose and everything just seems kind of like haphazard. And like sometimes it feels like Nishio Ishin's that dog, right? Squirrel, squirrel, squirrel. Like, You know, it's like we're going to spend 10 pages talking about catchphrases, and then let's just stop that and talk about something completely different now.
Well, speaking of Cheerio, like in the footnote, it says that he used this word because it's not a word that is used in Japanese. And does it mean something else beside cereal?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it actually says later on, he reiterates that she'll find out that it's actually like, I believe it's, isn't it? I think it's British in origin. But maybe not. But anyway, it basically means like, you know, see you later, top of the morning. Like, it's just like, it's like, oh, cheerio, and you'd leave, right?
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, it's basically like a way of saying goodbye. You know, it's like that kind of a slang, like see you later, you know, have a good day, that kind of stuff. Yeah, that's what it is.
Oh, that's why the cereal is called that. Oh, interesting.
Well, yeah. So it is actually a word, and it is actually, I believe, like I said, I do believe it has some British origins, which would, you know, kind of work because of you started having some of that British influence in Japan around, I guess, this time period they're in. So, yeah, like it would make sense, I guess. But yeah, she's going to find out that it has nothing to do with what she thought.
She thought it was chess, though, yeah, which is a kind of a war cry, yes, that you find most often in anime. And
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So look for the 5 pages of shame, or how many other pages he says it is. Like, I know it was a lot. I was like, oh, good. Here we go. It's another Monogatari, like 50 page diatribe on love that goes nowhere.
Well, and that's the thing I was wondering, like in the first book, she goes to this desert island to get his help, and since she was already betrayed by a ninja and a samurai because of money and like I think it's pride, she said, or something like
It's like this poison of the sword, the swords possess you.
But basically, like, she don't want to promise him, like, political status or money. And so she tells him, well, I'm giving you myself. Like, there's, beside her his sister, like, there's no other girl on this island. So she's giving herself to Shichika, but then you follow them along and, well, okay, she's upset that he's carrying her in like a princess cradle, or like, don't know how it's supposed to be.
That's
called.
That's like the bride carry.
Bridal style.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, bride carry. But like, she's upset that he's carrying her like this, but didn't you just pledge yourself to this guy when you ask for his help? And
and again, right, like I think that speaks to her character, is that, you know, she has all these schemes and ideas, but like somebody else was saying, they fall flat most of the time, which is part of the joke. And then the other things is like, she'll come up with ideas that when they actually do go her way, she's kind of surprised by it, or, you know, doesn't want it to go her way, or, yeah, like, I mean, it's, and that, I think that's the, and again, that's what I think makes the characters kind of fun and interesting, right, is that, you know, Shichika is being framed as this country bumpkin who doesn't know what he's doing, and yet he actually is quite capable, especially when he needs to be. And then you have this girl who's supposedly the schemer who's hell-bent on vengeance, and yet, you know, she doesn't seem like the brightest bulb sometimes.
Well, like, I wonder, how did she get to her position? Like, she, were her schemes always as successful as they are now?
Well, I think, you know what? I think what's interesting, I mean, there are a few times in the book where she makes a note of something and Shichika's like, you know, oh, for her to have been able to see that, I can see where now she could have risen to her position. Like, You know, I think one of the ones that just jumps to mind is when he beats when he does the whole feint with the samurai in the second one. She's like, you know, I understand you did this and this and this, but wouldn't there be a hindrance if this and this and this? And he's like, oh, the fact that she could pick up on all that just by watching me from behind, it demonstrates that she has these powers of observation and deduction and reasoning and stuff like that. So I think it's just that more like that she just gets flustered when it's him. I think she just doesn't know how to take him, right? Because, you know, it's been very clear that she's been surrounded by cutthroats and mercenaries and, you know, people that are far more worldly and, you know, are apparently prone to betraying you. And then she has this guy who is just like really upfront and completely honest and is like, yeah, I'm doing this for you. That's it. Like, you said you wanted me to fall for you. I have. I'm doing it for you. You know, and I think she just doesn't know how to take it.
Well, I almost think that it's kind of showing that she's out of her element, that she's doing something that, one, she's, you know, not particularly good at, and two, that she really shouldn't be doing at all. So that kind of gets hinted at, even in the first volume, that this sword hunt for these 12 swords isn't all that it seems to be.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Like, I mean, it's clear she doesn't do field work. Yeah. And she does say that a number of times. She's like, I'm the schemer. That's my whole point. I think I don't fight. I don't, you know, do martial arts. I think I scheme. I said we were going to cut this a little shorter just because, you know, it is 1 o'clock in the morning for most of us. I'll just summarize. So yes, we talked about the packaging of the book, which is really cool. The story is very typical Nishio Ishin. Did any of you guys want to make any final points or thoughts about the book so far, the series so far?
Well, there was one thing I want to point out. You know, at the end of each book, you have the kind of bio of every enemy.
Yeah.
Well, you also have in the bottom, like you have these kind of move set combo as if it was a fighting game instruction manual.
Yes.
And like they serve absolutely nothing. Like, and it's even in the story, like all of these moves, like they're barely used or mentioned, but I found it a really cool addition. Like, I always read them because, oh, that's cool. That's a nice bonus.
Mm.
Yeah. With Nishio Ishin, it feels like each series he does, you get a different Nishio Ishin. So you got Baka Monogatari, where it's, you know, first person, gets all up in everyone's heads, conversations, all that mess. You got the really kind of, I'd almost say awkward, Zare Gato, his mystery series.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other series like Madoka Box, where it's like almost 100% meta. With Katana Monogatari, it's really just straightforward adventure. I mean, you got the good character moments between the two, and even with the antagonists of each volume. But it's really one of the most digestible series that he's done. So I think it's a great pickup for, you know, just everyday readers or new fans of his.
Hmm. That's a good point.
I also want to point out that I found it interesting that in the last volume, he kind of wrote 1,000-time Legion.
Oh my God. I completely forgot about that part.
Yeah, and I did count. There's 1,000 word.
Yeah, so we didn't really mention it. I'll just mention it quickly. Like, each sword is unique in its own way. So, like, the first sword is supposed to be the strongest sword of the 12, so it's unbreakable. And then the second one is the sharpest sword of the bunch. And then the third one is, like, there's 1,000 copies of it. So, like, the whole plot of it is that the main antagonist has one of the swords, and she distributed the other 999 to, like, a bunch of her Miku. And for some reason, I guess for comedic sake, he decided when she attacks, she screams, like, a battle cry, Legion, and they just wrote Legion 1,000 times in a row. So, like, it's like three straight pages of just Legion.
Yeah.
I think it's not really mentioned, but that I thought at first that like every sword was screaming Legion at the same time, but I think it's not clear whether or not it's the main antagonist that screams Legion 1,000 times or each sword is emanating its own sound. I don't know.
I imagine it's probably each sword is doing its own sound, but because it's Nishio Ishin, he has to fill 3 pages with the word Legion.
Well, that was 3 pages that were quick to read. Well,
can you imagine now? I mean, okay. Like, we've talked about how meta and how, like, fourth wall breaking Nishio Ishin is. Can you imagine, like, he wrote this third book and his editor was like, you know, for page count wise, like, we need at least another 2 pages for our print run? And Nishio Ishin's like, all right. Challenge accepted.
It's like when you're writing a paper for school and it has to be a certain amount of words, and like, so if you can't think of anything, you just like do like,
you gotta have at least another 999 words in this manuscript. All right.
So you just hold down like one letter until you get enough letters, and you just color it white.
Yeah. Like, I just, yeah, I can see that. I just see that happening. In any case, so we'll wrap it up for tonight, because as I said, you know, it's quite late for all of us. Plus, you know, we don't want to flog a dead horse, because this is a relatively new book that I hope people will check out, because yeah, it's pretty cool so far. So I did say that we were going to be doing a giveaway. So Vertical, who were kind enough to send us these copies of these books, as part of their promotion for the series, they printed a set of 3 exclusive bookmarks. And we've got 3 sets that we are giving away to listeners in North America. I'm sorry to international fans, but it's being shipped out by Vertical, so they've requested North America. But I think that's about 95% of our listening audience, so it's most of you. So if you're in US or Canada and you would like to snatch yourself a set of the bookmarks, just go to the YouTube video. If you're watching this on YouTube, then it's easy enough. Just put it in the comments. If you're not, just go to our website, lightnovelpodcast.com, and I'll have a link to the YouTube video. Put a comment in the YouTube video along the lines of that you want a bookmark. And then we'll leave that open until December 31st, because this is the end of the year. And on January 1st or 2nd, depending on my state of mind on New Year's Day, we will post the results, the winners' names, on our website. Once again, lightnovelpodcast.com. And keep an eye out for it, and I'll try and get your contact information, and we'll get that all settled up. So again, just leave a comment on YouTube and, you know, give the video a like, which is always appreciated. So yeah, because YouTube loves it when our stuff gets liked, and so do I. So again, everyone, thank you very much for joining me. By the time this goes up, it'll be up before Christmas. So Merry Christmas or Happy Hanukkah. I guess we're already late to wish, but it's in the season, so it still counts. Happy Kwanzaa and all the rest of that kind of stuff. I'm probably missing 18 other different sort of celebrations. But have a happy holidays and a happy new year. And we will see you in 2019. So we're going to probably have a little bit of a break here. But in 2019, we will be back with our first episode, which we will look back on 2018 and talk about one or two of our favorite series that we read during the year of 2018. And we will talk about a couple series that we would love to see get licensed in 2019. So we'll look back and then look ahead. That'll be our next podcast. In the meantime, gentlemen, thank you for joining me at this ungodly hour of the night. And for all of you listeners, thanks for joining us. We will talk to you soon. Bye-bye for now. For show notes and related links, visit lightnovelpodcast.com.